you know that we're a language school and we do other services. We do translations and interpreting.
Do you want to talk up here?
Sure. Okay, interpreting and we have cultural programs like this on Sundays. And we are, we do some also some outreach to the community. And well, I'll go ahead and tell you that, and actually one of the interpreting, Rafe's wife is one of our interpreters, Rebecca, who just went down the hall with her daughters, and so that's how we got, we were very fortunate. She mentioned that Rafe might be interested in speaking here, and so they just moved here from California, how many months ago?
In July. Yeah.
Okay. And it's a little colder
in
California, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay. What part of California?
We were last in Los Angeles, but we've been all over. Oh. So we've been in Central California, which Rebecca thinks is the coldest place on Earth.
Surely not.
Not
after this. Okay. I'm going to read the introduction, and I think you all know. So Rafe, you've been. Let me ask you. You've been at Duke for
just since September. Yeah.
And before that,
I was at UCLA, and I've worked at. I did graduate work at UC Santa Barbara, and a few other schools in between. And I spent a little bit of time in Washington, D.C. as a science advisor to Congress. So I've seen the political side of things.
Okay. All right. And this is about the Sea of Cortez. And do all of you know, everybody know where the Sea of Cortez is?
We can see.
Okay, you can see where it is. Good. All right. And I think, that, you know, I'll let you go ahead and talk about the trip with Steinbeck in the spring in the early time. So our next talk before is going to be March 3rd or 4th, whatever the Sunday is, and we're going to have a speaker from Mexico. He's actually a journalist who's been there for years, and he's going to be speaking on No hay país sin maíz. There's no Mexico without corn. And so this is going to be a very interesting topic. And we'll send you more information about that. But that's going to be March, whatever. It should be fourth, right? Okay. All right, and thank you very much. And
all right. Thanks for coming out. We have a small group, so feel free to stop me anytime. This talk's going to start with the idea of the Sea of Cortez, but it's going to go sort of all over the place. It's really a talk more than about a place. It's about people and about philosophy as well. And it's specifically not so much centered on the author John Steinbeck, but on Ed Ricketts. And it's about a way of looking at the world based on natural history or observations. Yeah, that's fine. It works. And natural history, in the way it's been defined, and I don't usually give dictionary definitions in my talks, but I like this definition so much that I gave it. Webster said, natural history is a description of objects in nature, blah, 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 but then they added this part, and the phenomena which they exhibit to the senses, which is pretty remarkable for a dictionary definition. But as I think about the great natural historians that I know, people like my friend Gary Vermeij here, who says that the skill of observing natural history, in other words, is something that every science student must possess. And it's remarkable that Vermeij was saying observing in this case, because Vermeij has been blind since he was about 3 years old. And he's one of the best paleontologists living today. He can identify any snail, living or fossilized, that you put in his hand. So for him, it really is about the phenomena which your senses experience, this idea of natural history and observing. But it goes back a long way, this tradition of natural history and science. Of course, Darwin was a great natural historian, first and foremost. And he says, when morning came, everything appeared delightful. All nature seemed sparkling with life. So this idea of more than just describing animals and nature, but actually the experience of what these animals and plants and rocks give to you. And our friend Ed Ricketts picked up on this when he said, Darwin wasn't saying how it was with Valparaiso, but rather how it was with him. Being a naturalist, he said all nature was sparkling with life, but actually it was he who was sparkling. And so, and we wonder who this character Ed Ricketts is. He's a remarkable guy. He never finished college. He spent a little bit of time at the University of Chicago with some of the great early ecologists in the early 20th century. But he set up shop in Monterey on Cannery Row in California, and he set up this Pacific Biological Laboratory, which never was a huge commercial success, but kind of kept going along, and it was a commercial lab that collected specimens, preserved them, sent them out to schools and laboratories and that kind of thing. But almost more important than this marginal business was what went on in the lab in the off hours. It was really something of a salon in this lab where everyone from local drunks and prostitutes to local writers, poets, and philosophers would gather and listen to music, have these long parties that would go on for days, and talk about various philosophies and ways of looking at the world. And really, it was Ricketts who was at the center of this sort of intellectual hub in Monterey and his lab. And you see it in his writing that he goes much beyond a typical naturalist in the kind of things he says. Here he says, if he has strength or an energy of mind, meaning the naturalist, the tide pool stretches both ways, digs back to electrons and leaps space into the universe, and fights out of the moment into non-conceptual time, then ecology has a synonym which is all. And this really captures the depth and the breadth of thinking that Ed Ricketts really got into. He went much beyond just counting animals in a tide pool and really wanted to look at the whole picture and see how everything fit into the whole picture. And in this, too, he was really inspired by Darwin. In this process of building up, this is why I have this spiral design that comes up, but it's this idea of building up from small observations of rocks, of animals, of plants, and building up into a bigger picture. And what Ricketts said is the modern process, that of looking quickly at a whole field and then diving down to a particular. So here he's really talking about a lot of what we saw in the 20th century in biology and other sciences, like really getting down into very small particulars. He said that was the opposite of what Darwin was doing. Out of a long, long consideration of the parts, Darwin emerged with a sense of the whole. And this is really what Ricketts was after, was building up from a lot of observations into some bigger picture. He had this idea of what he called non-teleological thinking, and boiled down to a sentence, it was really this idea of looking at what is, not what should be, not what certain outside theories or rules would say, but actually taking those observations and seeing what is really going on in the world. And I was struck by this, when you say is, not should. It's very similar to this character Yoda in Star Wars. He would say, there is no try, do or do not. He was very focused on the real, what you were actually doing. And it's no coincidence, because Yoda was created by George Lucas. George Lucas was incredibly inspired by Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, who wrote Hero with a Thousand Faces. In fact, at one point, George Lucas said, Joseph Campbell is my Yoda. So he had this character in his movies who was sort of this sage, but the real life incarnation of that was Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell, in turn, was completely inspired by his friendship with Ed Ricketts. So they spent a lot of time together out in tide pools, collecting in his lab, talking about philosophies and theories, and you can see a lot of Ricketts' theories in Joseph Campbell's work.
What was Ricketts' time frame? When was he born?
I don't know his birth date, but he was really most active in the 1930s and 1940s. He died in 1948 prematurely in a car wreck, but most of the work, most of his interactions with Joseph Campbell and John Steinbeck were in the mid-1930s onward until his death.
Who was funding his research?
Ricketts? Mm-hmm. He was funding his research through that laboratory, selling those specimens. And if any of you have read Cannery Row,
he's the character Doc in Cannery Row, and a lot of those stories are true. He would have local kids round up cats, stray cats, and sometimes their own house cats, and euthanize them and send them off to laboratories. He would collect frogs. He would have the drunks on Cannery Row go and collect frogs in exchange for beer and that kind of thing. Now, the third important friendship here, the third piece of this puzzle, is John Steinbeck. Joseph Campbell and John Steinbeck never got along too well because early in their relationship, Joseph Campbell had a little bit of an affair with Steinbeck's first wife, Carol. So they were sort of always on the margins, but the connector between them was always Ed Ricketts. And Steinbeck especially was inspired by Ricketts. And an important point of time was 1939 for both of these men, Steinbeck and Ricketts. At that point, in 1939, John Steinbeck had published The Grapes of Wrath. At the same time, Ed Ricketts had published Between Pacific Tides, which is now in its fifth edition. It's one of the most important guidebooks to the tidal creatures of the Pacific Coast. And Ricketts saw it as one piece of a trilogy where he would look at the sort of California coast and the Oregon coast, and then have a separate piece looking at Mexico and a separate piece looking at the northern coast, Vancouver Island and Alaska. So it was timely that in 1939, after Steinbeck hit it big with The Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck was also itching to get out of Monterey because he was actually quite vilified there. Next to the fishing industry, the agriculture industry was huge in Monterey, and they were very upset to see this rather unflattering portrait of how the agricultural industry had used these Dust Bowl refugees coming to California, as depicted in The Grapes of Wrath. So he was sort of a pariah in the area at the time, and also didn't quite appreciate the notoriety that it got and really wanted to get out of town. The thing you notice about if you reread Grapes of Wrath from an ecological standpoint is you see the influence of Ricketts all over this book and how they talked about ecology and all the pieces, natural and human, going together. It's clear right from the prologue to The Grapes of Wrath, where this turtle is trying to cross the highway, and the whole symbolism of The Grapes of Wrath, which is really, in a way, an ecological novel. Likewise, Between Pacific Tides was quite a revolutionary book because rather than making a guidebook that just listed organisms and their taxonomic relationships, Ricketts wrote a book that put the organisms into their environment, where they lived, how they related to one another, not just those things that were most evolutionarily close to them. And that was quite a bit different than the typical academic treatment of biological organisms. So that was quite a radical book. Ricketts was happy to finally get it published. It took him a long time, in part because traditional academics, both by a little bit of snobbery, because he wasn't really a PhD academic, and also because of this new approach, sort of delayed the publication of this book somewhat. They were ready to get out of Monterey. Ricketts was ready to move on to the next part of this trilogy, which was to go down to Mexico. So they chartered a sardine boat. Sardines were the big industry in Monterey, but in the off-season, they were able to charter this sardine boat, the Western Flyer, and take it down to the Sea of Cortez. And when they went down there, they spent some time, a couple months, and you can see the Baja California Peninsula just south of California, and the red dots are all the sites that they went to. And what they did is they simply went to sites. They would take a boat from the main boat onto shore. They would anchor offshore, and they would just go there and just scour the rocks. They would turn over rocks. They'd look under reefs. They'd just look at everything they could find, and they'd collect almost everything they could if it wasn't something they knew directly, and they just recorded everything that they saw in two ways, and it's preserved in this book called Sea of Cortez, a leisurely journal of travel and research, where the front half of this book is a narrative text written by both Ed Ricketts and John Steinbeck about just their travels, their philosophies that they shared while on board, things that they saw, adventures they had, and the things that they saw on the actual collecting sites. The back half of the book is a scientific log of every organism that they collected. So it runs about 550 pages. This is out of print now, and if you go to a bookstore now, you'd find this as The Log from the Sea of Cortez, and it would just say John Steinbeck. That was sort of a marketing decision a few years after this book was published when they re-released it, so Ricketts kind of got written out of it. But now that we have access to Ricketts' original notes, we see even a lot of the prose is almost directly taken from Ricketts, so both of them should be authors. But what it is this thick tome is really an incredible record of everything they saw during the time that they were down there in 1940. Ricketts always wanted to go back there, but he spent the years after the Sea of Cortez journey up in the outer shores of Vancouver Island and British Columbia and Alaska, working on his third book that he wanted Steinbeck to write with him. And he died, unfortunately, in 1948, so he never made it back there. Since that time, scores of marine ecologists, such as myself, have been eager to go back and repeat this famous journey of this writer and this marine biologist. And the thing about marine biologists is we often have a lot of good ideas and plans that never get done because we're so busy looking at our own tide pools. But finally, at one point a few years ago, another writer, John Christensen, who was a Steinbeck fellow at San Jose State University, came down to the Hopkins Marine Lab. How many of you have ever been to Monterey, California? Okay, so you have the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which I'm sure you've seen. That was in the old Hovden Cannery. If you're looking at the coast and you went just half a block to the right, you would be at Ricketts' lab. If you went a few hundred yards to the left, you would be at the Hopkins Marine Station, which is the oldest marine biology lab on the West Coast. And that's run by Stanford University. John Christensen went down there and started talking with some of the faculty like Bill Gilley and Chuck Baxter, who's been my scientific mentor for a while. And they said, all right, let's finally do this trip. Got a little bit of money together, got an out-of-work fishing boat called the Gusty, which was Frank Donahue's boat out of Avila in sort of south central California. And it looks remarkably like the Western Flyer. You'll notice it's not as neat, but they really dolled up the Western Flyer for that trip. And the Gusty is a real working fishing boat. But it was a great place to work from. We went down to the same sites and more. The blue dots are other sites that we also visited because we were interested in those sites. But we were able to find, through Steinbeck and Ricketts descriptions, about 12 of the original sites that they went to. Other sites, we went to the same places, but we weren't sure we were in exactly the same location. Or in some cases, like down here, this is Cabo Pulmo. That's a coral reef. It's very rare habitat in Baja California. And Steinbeck and Ricketts at the time would just hammer out big sections of the coral and take it back up on board and break it up and find, you know, dozens and dozens of little worms and organisms, little brittle stars in there. We're obviously not going to do that because the reef is protected, and we didn't do any of that kind of destructive sampling when we could. So that's a site where we're in the same place, but we were really just looking using snorkel gear rather than getting in and breaking everything up. You can see the way we worked was basically just the way that they worked. We had the mothership would be anchored, and we'd lower on these skiffs, these outboard motorboats, and drop them down the water and motor into shore where we could work. Because a lot of these sites are fairly remote. There's still, in many of these sites, no roads. Some of them are on islands and that kind of thing. We did do some different things. For example, we did what's called transects. This is a more modern, sort of statistically relevant way of sampling a population, where you run a tape measure out and you put a little frame. This is a plastic frame might be, I think these are quarter meter square frames, and then you count everything you see in that frame, and you do that multiple times so you can sort of get an average of what the population is. Steinbeck and Ricketts didn't do any of that. They really just went out over the site and looked over everything and rolled over boulders, which we also did, and saw what was living under the rocks. You see, some sites are a bunch of loose boulders, and if you turn over those rocks, there's all kinds of things living under there. Some sites are big, solid rock, bedrock, and everything's growing on top of the rocks there, algae and other organisms, and in pools that those rocks form. So the method depends on the sites. We were using these more modern methods so that if we go back again, we can have a comparison that we can use modern statistical methods to compare. But the main thing we use is, just like those guys and just like Darwin, our eyes and our sense of natural history, really trying to observe very carefully everything that we saw. And then I would go back on board with some of the things that we'd collect and take sketches and that kind of thing for later identification. Steinbeck and Ricketts said, "We had time to play and talk and even drink a little beer." This is a great photo. There's fortunately been a couple of biographies of Ed Ricketts published lately. There wasn't a lot known about him except through Steinbeck until recently, when people had really poured through his archives. This is the only photo of Steinbeck and Ricketts together. Steinbeck and Ricketts, they went on a little hunting trip one of the days when they were anchored off a place called Agua Verde. And they actually never fired a shot, and they really enjoyed that a lot. They just kind of walked around with these hunting guides and had fires at night and had a good time. They were really happy not to have to shoot anything. But that's a sweet photo. But we basically did the same thing. We had a lot of time after the early morning low tides, when you could actually work in these tide pools, to just sit around on the deck of the boat and drink beer. We had a lot of visiting people. Reporters, this is Mark Schwartz from the Stanford News Service. We had students sometimes come on board. We had a whole cast of characters. This is John McChesney, who's an NPR reporter, who did a story on this. They said famously, "We took 2,160 individuals of species of beer." So the first thing of people who are familiar with this journey asked me is, how many species of beer did you take? And I note that population-wise, we took a little less, 1,728 versus 2,160, but we had a greater diversity of beer available to us, thanks to the North Coast Brewing Company, who donated us cases and cases and cases of beer. It was filling up the hold. So the more serious comparisons come when you actually get into the text of this Sea of Cortez, and look at the species that they talk about, the species that live in tide pools like the snails and the brittle stars, but also the things like the tuna and the manta rays that they saw while they were cruising along on the boat. All those things are still there, but when you look at their descriptions and our descriptions, you see that a lot has changed. And I'm going to go through these changes, which we think we can say with quite a bit of confidence that these things have changed. What we don't have as much confidence in is what's the explanation of the changes. So I'll sort of mention those, but understand that I believe that these explanations are still speculative until we get some more information. But there are changes in the actual locations, in echinoderms, which are things like starfish and sea cucumbers. We'll run into those. Some of the larger snails, their populations have changed, and I'll tell you why those are important. And then this odd group of tube snails has changed quite a bit. And pelagic species, by that, those are the free swimming species like marlin and tuna and sea turtles and whales. Those have all changed in population quite a bit. And then there's this really interesting story of the jumbo squid. So I'm gonna quickly go through each of these. Some sites change quite a bit, like Cabo San Lucas. When Steinbeck and Ricketts went to Cabo San Lucas, they said, "The night was extremely dark when we rounded the end. The coast pilot," that was their sort of navigational guidebook, "spoke of a light at the end of St. Lucas Pier, but we could see no light." And that's because the lighthouse then, at that time, was powered by a generator, and they'd shut down the generator at night, so they had no lighthouse there. Not too helpful. This is probably what it looked like, though this photo's from 1947, Steinbeck and Ricketts never got their photographic gear to work well, or they didn't try too hard. So this is about the best I can show you of what Cabo San Lucas looked like in 1947. There's a cannery and a couple shacks on the bluff. This is an estuary that goes back from the coast. But when they got to the rocky shore there, and remember, these guys are coming from Central California. They've been all over California to some of the most beautiful tide pools on Earth. They got down to Cabo San Lucas and were blown away by the diversity of life there in the tide pools. These are guys that should be jaded to sort of the diversity of things that you would see on a West Coast tide pool, but they were just blown away. What we see now is the ferocious life in Cabo San Lucas is jet skis and massive resorts. It's so bright you can actually see it from space at night. So the light is much higher there now. And what it looks like, this is a photo I took, or actually Linda Cicero took from the same angle. The cannery would have been down here. This whole back estuary has been built up with marinas. There's a gas station down there. There's farming, massive hotels along the whole coast here. So you have a completely different environment. And indeed, when we got to the tide pools there, also being very experienced with Central California tide pools, there was really not a lot to write home about, except that the tide pools were much less diverse and much less abundant than what Steinbeck and Ricketts report. Echinoderms are an interesting group of animals. They have things in this group are things like sea stars. They report a number of species everywhere they went, and we saw many fewer, usually zero or one individual species of sea stars there, where they would see four or five or six. So we knew everywhere we went, we were seeing a lot fewer of these sea stars. Also, another example of an echinoderm is sea cucumber. It literally looks like a cucumber. It's actually related to a sea star. They said in one place, we saw literally millions of these cucumbers. And now we can do all our statistical sampling, but at the end of the day, we know when we go out there, we're not seeing millions of these at all. We might be seeing several dozen or something like that. Another example, they don't do any statistical work in their book, but they say things like, it was simple enough to pick up hundreds at a time of these brittle stars in black, twisting, squirming knots. So there's an image that's very clear. And yet, when we would turn over a rock, we would see one or two or maybe three. Nothing you would ever assume was hundreds at a time in twisting, squirming knots. So again, even though they don't use statistical techniques or have those hard numbers, their natural history allows you to make this comparison. What's going on here? There's a couple explanations, again, kind of speculative, but I have friends, like my friend Jonathan Stillman studies these little crabs, porcelain crabs are called, and they live under rocks. And what he's found is these crabs, if you look at what kind of temperatures they can withstand in a laboratory, and then you look at the temperatures they're actually experiencing in the rocks in the field, the temperatures they're actually experiencing is right near their lethal limit. So the idea is, if the temperatures rise just even a few degrees, that could potentially push these kind of species that live under the rocks over the edge. And of course, we have seen, since Steinbeck and Ricketts' time, ocean temperatures and shoreline temperatures rising a few degrees on average. And those habitats under the rocks really do get baking when the sun beats down on the rocks and heats them up. That's one potential thing that's going on with these brittle stars and these sea cucumbers, which live just under the boulders in that little bit of water that's retained there at low tide. Another thing that we see in Central California, and we also saw, at least from one report in the Sea of Cortez, is this wasting disease that goes through echinoderms. This is a bat star that's literally just dissolved away due to this disease. And what we see with this disease is it comes back with a vengeance every time there's sort of warm water years. And so more and more frequently we've been seeing this disease come in. So we think there was this big event in about 1979, I believe, in the Sea of Cortez, which just killed off everything. And we think that every time these populations try to recover, another big warm year comes by, because we've been having these very frequent warm water years, and brings this disease back and kills them back off, or they maintain the disease and it gets active.
What was that event?
The event in the late 70s was some kind of disease. They didn't identify it at the time, that just went through and killed off almost all of the big, they're saying top carnivore. The top carnivore are these starfish that are actually carnivorous. And almost all of them died off in the Gulf of California or the Sea of Cortez in the late 70s. A few survived, and we think their populations just keep getting beat back down whenever a reemergence of this disease comes through.